Today on Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz, we return to the first season in 1979 with pianist, composer, and founder of the Modern Jazz Quartet, John Lewis, as our guest. Our program begins with John Lewis playing the blues.
John, I just love the way you play the blues. I almost got into it myself. What a kick having you here on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Marion.
You know, this is the first, of course I've heard you on records recently, but this is the first time I've been with you in a playing situation since we were in Japan, I think.
That's true. I think that is the last
yes,
time.
Yes, what a kick. And, you know, listening to you play the blues, I learned so much from you over the years, the way you play the blues, just so economical and so spare and yet so right. You know, you just started something out and just in fact, you know what I was thinking to myself? I was so tempted to get into that and play, and then I thought, well, I'd better not because I'll louse things up. But just do one chorus and let me just play on that a little bit.
Thank you.
Oh, that's such fun. It becomes something altogether different with two pianos. And playing two pianos with somebody is really like being on the tennis court or playing a golf game. I think you really know something about people that you never knew before.
Yes, it's and true,
and how they listen and how they accompany, and you know, one steps back and the other steps forward. And it seems to me I was doing all the stepping forward on that one.
No, you were not.
Goodness.
Yeah, that's true. Because pianists don't have an opportunity often to play with other pianists. We play with other drummers, other bass players, so we know what they feel like. But the pianists rarely know what the other pianists feel like.
I know. But you've been probably doing a lot of different things. Well, even since I saw you in Japan, I'm not sure if you were teaching at City College then, were you?
Yes, because I've been there for the last four, going on 5 years now.
Well, is that after, that's when the quartet broke up?
Right.
Broke up's the wrong word, because you get together
retired,
again.
We
retired, but then every so often you get together
well,
again.
Well, once we came out of retirement on request.
And
now
recorded.
We've retired again.
Yeah, but now you're probably going to do it again on request.
No,
I'll bet.
I doubt it.
Well, I don't know. You probably should, because I think what you did was something so marvelous to put a group like that together, the modern jazz quartet, and work everywhere that you worked, all the European countries and all over the world, in fact, and build up such a great name for your group and for jazz. I think what you did was something so special, because it took jazz, it made jazz more... dignified, or what's the word?
Well, made it have more consideration as something that's important.
Yes, that's what
in people's lives.
Yeah,
that's
that it really is an important music. And
yes,
I mean, you
I
made
it
so. Yeah. And I don't think that the impact of your quartet will ever be forgotten, if whether you put it together again or not.
Well, I'm pleased and proud of what we did together for people. Because it was four people. It was a democratic institution where there were four people who shared the work, shared the benefits, shared the disadvantages and advantages. We shared the whole thing, all four. And all four now all seem to be very happily ensconced in whatever they want to do now. I see Connie occasionally. He works down at Eddie Condon's, feels quite happy down there playing.
Yeah, he seems
and then
to.
Goes out and plays with Benny Goodman on occasion when he wants to. So he's happy. I saw Milt recently at the Monterey Jazz Festival, and we had a nice little get-together. He I don't see as much because he's out on the road all the time. He's a workaholic.
Yeah, he
likes to work all the time.
He loves to work.
And Percy and I went to Japan together. I just, about 3 weeks ago, came back from Japan. We took a kind of mini Monterey Jazz Festival there for 1 day. Played one concert.
For one day in Japan?
Right.
That's very jet-setting.
It's
very chic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Goodness. It must have been, what a trip.
It was fun, though. Percy was the bass player, and Mel was the drummer. Mel Lewis was the drummer. And Kenny Burrell was the guitarist.
That's nice.
And Dizzy and Thad were the trumpet players.
Oh, goodness.
And Sonny Sitt and Benny Golson were the principal saxophone players. Then we took a young high school student from California who won this honor to go with us, and also a very nice prize from the Japanese radio station. We went there for Tokyo Broadcasting System.
What did he play? The
saxophone. You know, he's 17 years old. He's a wonderful arranger, a wonderful saxophone player. And he's Mavis Rivers' son. You remember Mavis Rivers?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I saw Mavis just a little while ago when she was here with Red Norvo.
It was her son.
That's fantastic. Yeah. What's his name?
I'll have to try and remember. It was a hard name because his father's from the Philippines.
Yes, right.
So
I've got to watch
out
for
him.
Well, I'll ask Mavis next time I see her. But then that must have been, you haven't actually worked that much with Dizzy over the years since you were with him.
Well, let's see.
Or have you?
On odd occasions where we're there together, I always play with him. He makes me play with him.
I bet he does.
Any place in the room or anything. And I see him usually at each year at Monterey and also in Nice. I see him and I always play a set with him.
Well, when you first came to New York, Wasn't he one of the first people you started playing with?
Well, that was my first kind of long-term professional job in 1946. First as an arranger for Dizzy for about 6 months while I was waiting to get my union card.
You were coming here from New Mexico?
Yes. Well, I came from New Mexico after having only been home for about a month from the war, coming from the European theater. And the reason I came to New York was mainly because of Dizzy. While I was there, Dizzy had this legendary sextet playing at Billy Berg's in Los Angeles with Charlie Parker, Milt Jackson, Ray Brown, Al Haig, Stan Levy, and himself. And it was so incredible, the broadcast I'd listened to each night from Billy Berg's, I said, well, that's it. Kind of afraid I'm going to have to leave home. go to New York. So I did. So I came to New York and went to school first and then was introduced to Dizzy by Kenny Clark. Kenny Clark and I were in the Army together.
Oh, really?
Yes, 2 years ago.
Well, he was your first drummer in the quartet, wasn't
Yes, because we were old friends. We slept in foxholes, things like that together. And so he took a couple of arrangements that I'd written down to Dizzy, and Dizzy liked them, so he hired me as an arranger. I couldn't work with him as a pianist, and they were playing in the spotlight. So then he asked, and also Monk was the pianist at the time.
Monk was the pianist, right, Dizzy. Goodness.
Big band at the time. But then when they got ready to go out on the road, I started playing with Dizzy. I guess the first job I had, though, with Dizzy was Record Date, where we recorded Things to Come. That was my first job playing.
Now, I forget that one, but did you didn't record the Salt Peanuts and Hot House, did you?
No, those
Wasn't
are the
that
ones
Al
that
Haig?
Were in, those were in, yeah, well, yes, some of those were Al Haig, and those are the things that were made early in 45.
Because, you know, that was my first introduction to what I know you reluctantly call bebop. And I was in Paris at the time, and we were at Charles Delaunay's house, and Django was there. And Charles Delaunay was playing this record, you know. I can't even play it, but, you know. And I'm sitting there saying, what is that? What's happening? What's the piano player doing? And he was just going, you know, little stabbing chords. Yeah. And I remember asking this ridiculous question. Does a piano player have all that written out? Can you imagine if you tried to write that out? So, but that was the first record that I heard. And but that, as you say, was before you joined. So you did Things to Come. And what else was on the record?
No, well, I played on that record. Let's see. I think they were from Musicraft when he was recording them. Let's see, what else? Oh,
the ones he
one
did.
Bass hit was also recorded.
Yeah.
There. This was with the big band, though, that he had then. Let's see, what else did he record? Ray's Idea was another.
Manteca?
That was later. That was in 47. These were in 46. In 47, recorded Manteca and recorded two bass hit, Peace of Mind, it was called then. I've changed the name since.
That's the blues, isn't it? Or is it?
Well, it's kind of blues. It's some other stuff that surrounds it. In the middle, the core of it is the blues, the improvised section.
I always get mixed up. That's something else, isn't
right.
it? Or is that yours?
No, that's not. Let's see. Two bass hit was like this.
But see, I'm still an ignorant Britisher.
Most knowledgeable.
I'm always catching up, you know. Like as fast as I learned to play bebop, they changed and went to something else. I guess it would be kind of fun to explore one of those bebop tunes because most of them, I guess if not all, were taken from either the blues or a pop tune that they superimposed a melody on.
Right, in the early part, right after the war, most of the tunes were new tunes based upon older chord progressions, which is a necessary transition before you can get to new chord progressions. It's easier for the musicians to manage.
Well, what would you think with some of the earliest bebop tunes? Or bop tunes.
Well, that piece that you play is based upon, what is it, based on Indiana?
Oh, the Charlie Parker's Donna Lee.
Right.
That one? Oh, I don't know if I can get through this, but we'll see. I guess I haven't played that thing in so long. That's another thing about those pieces. I'm copping out because if I'd known I was going to play that, I should have practiced.
Yeah,
it.
No.
But that's another thing about they're hard.
I don't, right?
You know, something you said before, like that music isn't easy to play.
No, remember
this thing Bud Powell had. Afternoon in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Parisian thoroughfare. Afternoon in Paris is yours.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I begin to think I must have played that wrong because I remember one night in the Carlisle, I played that tune.
Oh, no. And
did I play it wrong?
Yeah, no. I enjoyed that. Because you played that.
I love that tune. Yeah. I really love to play that one. That one and Delaunay's Dilemma. Ah. I'd love to do that later on, but you know what I'd really love to hear you do, if you would, and that's my favorite of all your compositions, Django.
Okay.
That's such a beautiful piece. And it has such classical overtones. Do you think that comes from your training? You did train classically, didn't you?
Yes. Well, let's see.
Or is it just thinking of Django made you...
Thinking of Django.
Thinking
of where Django comes from, Europe. And
yeah.
This, which I have a tremendous affection for, which I'm sure you know.
For Europe?
Yes.
Oh, I know you do. I know. Especially after being in that beautiful little house there on the hill.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy, that's nice. But that probably has been recorded by a great many people. I heard George Shearing play it at the Carlisle when we were there.
Yeah.
And I should play it more than I do, because we played that as a duet in Japan.
Right.
You know, I was just thinking while you were playing that, it's so different, isn't it, playing solo piano and making it swing as to when you have a bass player and drummer. I mean, what do you tell the kids at school? Because a lot of them have to start playing solo piano, don't they?
Right, well, they have to understand it's two different things. I find you can't play the same way. You can't even play the same tempos. I can't play the same tempos that I play with a trio as I play by myself.
Maybe that's a mistake I make. I sometimes start a tune by myself, and I say, "Help! What did I do?" You know, learned something.
You're used to playing by yourself.
Play them slower. but you make it. You know, you have to give a feeling of pulse or of swinging to the thing.
That's right. To imply it.
And it isn't always so many notes. It's what you did on that first blues. Play just a little bit of that, because you really establish that the thing is swinging immediately. See, it's relaxed, and that melody, the way it's notated, that it just gives you a feeling. You know right where the tempo is.
Right, I think. Well, because I teach the kids up there young people, that once that first phrase has been played, that's the tempo, and there's where you must stay if you want your piece to have a feeling of that particular kind of swinging, of being very steady.
In other words, don't rush or drag.
After you started it,
you stuck with it. I know. Well, what do they say? It's bad enough if you rush, but it's a real sin to drag. Gee, I'd like to have a go at one of your earlier things, or maybe you'd like to play it with me. A tune of yours I've always loved, and maybe it came out about the same time as the Queen's Fancy, Delorna's Dilemma.
Oh, good.
Do you still play that?
Yes, just to try and remember.
Because that has that same feeling with the melody.
I'm going to follow you. Thank you.
touch you or anything.
Delaunay's Dilemma, played by Marion McPartland and her guest pianist and composer John Lewis. And there's more talk and music coming up on Piano Jazz. You can get information about guests and the music heard on the program on our website, pianojazz.npr.org. This is Piano Jazz.
What about some of those things that you wrote? You wrote tunes for the whole family, for Sasha and Nina and Mariana. And I don't think I'm as familiar with all those as I should be. I wish you'd play one of those for me. Which one are you going to do?
Maybe I'll play Mariana.
She'll like that. Thank you. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Mariana must have really loved that. That's very nice. Now, that's really has a classical feeling, a waltz, like a waltz, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm wondering if people really know how hard it is to accompany yourself, or how much you have to change from what you would do if you played this with a group. But I mean, you would. There's so much that's different.
Yeah, right.
But I meant to talk about before, and I was thinking of another of your tunes that I like to play. Maybe I could do a little bit of it alone, and then have you come in just to show how much nicer it is with two pianos. Afternoon in Paris.
Oh, great.
Okay. Thank you. the way we rehearsed it. Oh, I love that thing. That's a tune really stands up over the years. You know, some of them you play them and forget them, like, Feelings or something like that. Uh-huh. But to me, that's a tune that it's lovely to play on. I really have enjoyed that thing for years.
And yeah, nicely.
That part in the middle, you know, I have some doubts about whether I'm playing. Is that right?
Yes, you have that choice, or you can.
We'll see now. Lesson all for free.
You know, the nice thing is with this wonderful music that we play, wonderful way of making music, is that we can find many different ways to show what a piece is like.
I know. I know. Billy Taylor was talking about how Art Tatum used to play with some other piano player, and they would play, after they played the tune, they would keep changing the harmony. You probably know about that. you knew Art Tatum, I'm sure.
I listened to Art Tatum. I talked to him for a little bit. I didn't want to know Art Tatum. I didn't want to know Duke Ellington.
Really?
I didn't want to know for this reason. This is all my foolishness, probably. For me, what those people did and made, that was church, I guess. It was a perfect thing. I didn't want it spoiled by knowing anything else. I didn't care about the rest.
In other words,
I cared about what they did.
So. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. In other words, sort of like they were God to you almost.
Yes, right.
And to the rest of us too, I think. But yeah. Nevertheless, I must admit, I was bowled over when Art Tatum walked into a club where I was playing, and I had Joe Morello and Bill Crow with me, and Bill was bent over the bass, and Joe doesn't see very well, as you know. So I thought, boy, if I tell them, then three of us are going to be nervous. Better just one should be nervous. I was so nervous, I thought I was going to die.
I would have died.
I didn't die, but I almost did. And then, of course, you immediately try to play better, and then, or get careful, and it wasn't until years later somebody said something to me, I guess Charlie Shavers, and he says, well, you shouldn't feel that way, because when those people come in, they come in to be entertained by you, and you shouldn't get nervous like that. You should try to entertain them. I said, well, that's all very well. It's all very well. Like when I was in the Hickory House and I saw Benny Goodman, or when Duke came into the Hickory House, again, I thought I was going to die, but he was... very compatible, and we became great friends. But I do understand your attitude, and what do you play of his? What's your favorite Duke Ellington piece?
Oh, let's see. What have I played? Either Perdido or Satin Doll, or what else?
Oh, that's one of my favorites, Prelude to a Kiss. Do that one.
Okay, see what'll happen with it.
I'll bail you out. That's one I happen to know. If you need to be bailed out, that's one tune I do know. I love that tune. I was going to go back to the bridge.
I gotta learn that.
No, but isn't that a pretty bridge? Oh, I just love the, yeah, the way he gets back out of it again. Love to mess with those things. Pretty tune, Prelude to a Kiss. You know, I guess that wherever you go, you've been to many more places than I have, like to Australia. I bet they're just as good there, aren't they?
Yes, there are wonderful audiences in Australia, yes.
And in Japan, I thought that was fabulous.
You know, on this last trip, we had, you know, it was a special occasion in a big hall called Budokan. We had 10,000 people.
That's what's even better.
10,000.
That's what's
young teenagers.
Well, do you remember? I just recall an incident when we were somewhere in that snowy, cold area, and we were waiting for the train, and we went up the hill in this ice and snow to a little bar or a little place to get coffee and a sandwich. And over here, it would be like, some real small town, like maybe in Arkansas or someplace. And we went in and sat down. And this guy knew you and whipped out about 10 of your albums.
And he gave me a pair of straw shoes.
But can you imagine this happening here, maybe to go to Kentucky or someplace, and you would go into a coffee shop for a cup of coffee, and the proprietor would say, I know you, and he would bring out copies of your albums. I mean, you'd die if that happened. You'd faint. You know, I've enjoyed talking with you so much, John, that I just forget all about the time, and I'd love to sit here for 2 or 3 more hours, but I guess we can't. So, how about winding up with something we can both do, like one of the tunes we did in Japan?
Fine.
What?
Let's see, we did Storming the Savoy, Edgar Sampson's.
Oh, we can do that one. Okay, go ahead.
And also, and thank you, Marion, for having me on your show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm enjoying it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with Marian McPartland and her guest, John Lewis, in a program which originally aired in 1979. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. This program was produced by Dick Phipps and recorded by John Gelinas, with post-production engineering by Tom Sheely. Executive producer, William D. Hay. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, from the Friends of Piano Jazz, and from NPR. Support for the digital restoration of this classic program was provided by Save America's Treasures through a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. The original production was made possible by Dixie Electronics Incorporated, the National Endowment for the Arts, and NPR. Support for NPR comes from NPR contributors, which include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.